a sound. Logic podcast. Two guys with no credentials. Reviewing Rolling
Stone 500. Greatest album.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Sound Logic podcast. And today we're doing something a little different. We're kind of between seasons. We've finished episode, our 100th review. And before we do our 101st review, we usually take a little break. But also we wanted to talk about something fairly significant that has happened in the world of music and the world of culture, and something close to us. Ben, do you want to kind of introduce what we're talking about today, just so I'm not rambling for too long all at once?
Yeah. Guitarist, songwriter, singer, leader of the band, Robbie Robertson, passed away here recently, August 8th or 9th, somewhere in there. It was announced
a couple weeks ago
by his family. He had apparently been ill for some time, but learning of that, learning of it in, you know, the same space of Gordon Lightfoot, and not too far removed from other Canadian icons who've passed away, I guess, over the last number of years, it's hit us a little bit closer to home, and maybe perhaps especially since we just re-released our review of music from Big Pink, and and I know for me, I owe a lot to this podcast, not just because it's been a lot of fun hanging out with you, but for the ability to get to know bands I should have known a long time ago, like the band. It's been really great, and maybe makes it hit a little harder, perhaps, than had we never started this misguided, long-running podcast. Well-intentioned podcast. Well, that's better. Yes. That's better than misguided.
That's better. Yeah. In the years since we've started this journey, it's been over 4 years now. We've lost a few musical legends that we've talked about. And that's you know, when you really get into something, it makes it a little harder. I can speak. I think for both of us, myself for sure, I don't think there's a group that has surprised me and become more beloved to me through doing this than the band. I was familiar with the band before. I had one of their greatest hits, but never really done a deep dive. And then doing this, it's definitely the group that I listen to the most from this list, from this project we've done. And I'm buying their vinyl. I'm getting into, you know, our wonderful guests. We had Tyrell Listen, who hosts the podcast The Band of History, which is excellent, by the way. If you haven't checked it out, he does such an in-depth dive into the history of the band, and then going through even once they get into their solo and side projects and The Last Waltz, and people who have interviewed them and photographed them. It's really well done, and he's just a huge fan as well. It's just been such an incredible gift to have that music. So losing another legend in Robbie Robertson, not just a Canadian legend, a music legend, a cultural legend. I mean, you start looking at his band, look at lists of movies he's scored.
All
the movies with Scorsese, most recently, Killers of the Flower Moon. Is that what it's called? A new movie,
Killers of the Flower Moon. Yep,
is that what it's called? With DiCaprio and Scorsese directed it, and Robbie did the score, and he did many over the years for Scorsese. Such a big part of our culture. So it's just giving me pause to reflect as we lose another legend, and a long and full life. Not to say that it isn't sad when his people close to him. When you lose someone who's close to you, of course, it's still sad. He made it a lot longer than some of his contemporaries who lived a similar lifestyle. And if you listen to the podcast, you can hear that for those guys, except for maybe Garth, they all lived a pretty hard lifestyle at different times. Robbie came out, in his 81st year. And yeah, he will be greatly missed by those who knew him and many fans all over the world. I gotta say, sometimes it's a little bittersweet when I think of Robbie, because sometimes it seems from reading that he was kind of the deciding factor in doing the Last Waltz and and the band kind
band
of
didn't even know, right?
closing that chapter. And then, of course, the rest of them a few years later in the 80s said, hey, we want to keep doing this and start it up again without him. So I think about that sometimes, and I wonder what could have happened. But maybe it was for the better that they wouldn't have gone on, you know, into the 80s and 90s perhaps, as they did, if it had remained in the same. So nothing, of course, against Robbie for that. You know, it all happened for a reason. And boy, I'm just so thankful for the gift of his music. I mean, he was the primary songwriter for their group. He wrote the vast majority of their songs. I put it on my turntable quite a lot and online. And it's just give me lots of reflection. Anything in particular come to mind, Ben, when you heard of the passing, or in the days or weeks after? How did you kind of commemorate Robbie?
Well, this happened almost by accident, but former guest on the podcast, Andrew Hickey from the incredible podcast, The History and Published Work, A History of Rock Music in 500 Songs.
Right,
coincidentally released his 167th episode in the grouping of 500. This one was focusing on The Weight by the band. And he went into quite a bit of depth, as he normally does. I think it's a 2-hour podcast episode, which is not unusual for him, but going all the way back to you know, the beginning of the Hawks, and you know, the way that things evolved from that point to working with Dylan, and then finally sort of looking around and realizing they were the band and creating music together. So I think more than anything, it was a reminder again of just how much Canadian music history he was a part of, over such a long time, as you already mentioned. And good, just doing some really powerful and incredible stuff. I agree that those, especially those two albums that we've talked about on the podcast, but also Northern Light, Southern Cross, has really become three staple albums that just continue to be in my regular rotation when I want something I know I'm going to like when I press play or drop the needle. And I haven't gone as deep as I probably should have in the rest of their catalog. And I'm sort of, his passing has nudged me a little bit to think, like, there's got to be more good stuff out there. Like, keep going, going. Yeah. Don't stop. Don't stop now. But, yeah.
We don't want to make this too long. We want to, of course, just you know, commemorate Robbie. And, you know, of course, our condolences to his family in all of this. And those who knew him, and many knew him well in the industry. Ben, did I tell you about my trip to Orillia where I went into a record store?
No.
Days before his passing, maybe a week before his passing, I was with my parents and my kids, went to a town north of here, if you know the area, north of Lake Simcoe, called Orillia. We were visiting a museum there, and then we went into the main, kind of main strip of this old town, beautiful main street if you haven't been. Orillia is, of course, the hometown of Gordon Lightfoot. And I think the home of the Mariposa Folk Festival. There's big cutouts of guitars painted beautifully all over the streets, and there's commemorations, murals to Gordon Lightfoot. Anyways, we're walking by, going to a restaurant to see this music store, this record store, and I go in and realize it's actually three units that are connected together, almost records, like, just wild. So of course I go right to the band section to see if I can pick up some of the ones I don't have. I like to get vintage copies if I can. Sometimes they're a little less expensive, and I just like that having something that's older. I like old things. So I'm looking, and I couldn't find music from Big Pink or the Brown album, but there were several copies of Stage Fright, which okay. is another one. So I picked up Stage Fright. I found the disc in the best condition, and I took it home and have been playing it. And then and I showed my mom, of course. And then when we heard of Robbie's passing, she texted me, said, "You looks like you got the album just in time." I guess kind of wondering if the value would skyrocket, right? As sometimes happens. I don't know that will happen, but I said, it is kind of timely, isn't it? But just there's so much that happens to me right now.
Yeah.
That the band is a part of it, whether it's on the radio or something I listen to or talking to somebody or seeing a picture. I feel like it's like when you see a car or somebody brings something to your attention and you've seen it all along for years, but you never really looked at it. I feel that way with a band now that I see them everywhere. Yeah. I see their influence everywhere.
Yeah. The sound they were creating.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh yeah. Anyways, that's my little story from.
I love that. I love that.
Weeks ago,
we mentioned our conversation with Tyrell. Listen, we thought it would be appropriate to bring his voice back to the Sound Logic podcast, and so we're going to replay that conversation with him. It's about a half an hour, so it's not a full length episode here, but it was such a good time to get to know him in a little bit of a way, and. In tribute, I guess, to Robbie, we'll replay that here for you now.
So we will have some new episodes coming out in the next few weeks, but in the meantime, enjoy this this little conversation with Tyrell. He's such a great band fan to have with us, and very knowledgeable and well-spoken. And of course, Robbie, wherever you are, rest well. Thank you for your contribution to music, to Canadiana, to Americana, and so many other things. We're just so thankful that we got to enjoy what you've made over the years.
Absolutely. Thanks, Robbie. We'll have more coming up right after this.
No credentials.
Rolling Stone 500 greatest album.
Welcome back, everyone, and thanks for joining us again here at the Sound Logic podcast. And today we are discussing an album we've already reviewed on the previous list. This is album number 57. It is the band's self-titled album, also known as the Brown Album, by the band. And today we have something different for you. Instead of just our normal ramblings, we have a special guest joining us today. Ben, would you introduce our guest for us, please?
Yeah, we haven't done this yet. We've had guests on the show before, but it's usually when we're tackling an album for the first time. This is a album we previously reviewed. And in the meantime, since we last reviewed it, which was, it's getting close to 2 years ago, Mike, since we put that review out there initially. Yeah. I discovered something kind of amazing called The Band, A History. It's another podcast, another in-depth music podcast that focuses specifically on the Canadian group, The Band. And we're really excited to have the creator of that podcast with us here this evening. Tyrell Listen is our guest. He's put this together. He's in the midst of this project, I guess you would say. And he's here to talk a little bit more about that and to talk about a shared commonality that we all have in the band as three Canadians. Tyrell, for those who don't know you, how might you introduce yourself these days?
Yeah, no, thanks. First of all, thanks for having me, guys. It's a pleasure. I am the host, producer, writer, a little bit of everything, as you know, we all are when it comes to podcasts for the Band of History project, detailing the roots rock band, The Band. And I've been doing the project for coming up on almost 3 years, believe it or not. It started just after Christmas in 2019.
Wow.
So it's been a long time. But yeah, we take a in-depth look at the band. It's for fans of the band, but also we're encouraging new folks that, you know, might have heard The Wait or one of the other big band songs that want a little bit more knowledge. And we do some interviews too with people from the band that were around the band, etc. So yeah, it's been a journey so far.
Well, I will count myself as one of those people who used to just know their radio hits. And I'm a little embarrassed to say that as a Canadian, but it really was because of this podcasting journey that I got more into the band, specifically the two albums that we've talked about before, Music from Big Pink and this one that we're discussing here tonight. And it's really because of sort of falling down that rabbit hole, discovering all this other music that I didn't know and how great it is that I've gotten into other parts of their career, which led me to your podcast. So thank you for putting it together. It's a huge help for me as a fairly ignorant music fan, and it's helped along the way for sure. We can empathize a little bit with the searchability challenges of podcasting. Not necessarily that Sound Logic isn't a misnomer or anything like that, but we tell people that we are talking through Rolling Stone's list of the greatest albums. I've had a few people say, I didn't realize the Rolling Stones had that many albums that you could have a whole podcast on. No, the magazine, the Rolling Stones. So yeah, when you type the band into a podcast search engine, I'm guessing that it can be quite challenging for your people even to find you.
Certainly. And, you know, back in 1965, 66, 67, in that time when the band kind of stumbled upon their name, they didn't even give their name really to themselves, but they weren't thinking of search engine optimization or anything like that. So yeah. It's definitely a challenge sometimes, but no, it's been incredibly great. I always like to shout out my community of people. The band community is a tight knit group, and they welcomed me immediately, as well as members from the band, et cetera, and helping promote the work, which was a huge foot up at the beginning. And now we have a very robust community of really engaged band fans, new and old. So it's been remarkable seeing people that, you know, were around when these guys were, you know, 15, 16 years old playing the circuit, and, you know, new fans that are 16, 17 year old. It's now getting into the band for the first time. So it's kind of, it's really full circle in a lot of ways. And it's really cool to see.
That's awesome.
Well, I guess my first question is, I have two, but we'll start here. What first attracted you to the band? Just listening to other things and it came across? Or was it somebody who kind of handed something to you and said, you got to hear this? How did you get into it first?
Yeah, no, I have an interesting story, and I've told it a few times, but I always think it's really funny because I, like many other people, heard The Wait probably on the radio or something. You know, in Canada, you have CanCon, so like they have to play Canadian music so many times an hour on the radio. So I'd heard The Wait and I didn't like it. I actually hated it. I thought it was,
no.
I was like, oh, God, but this was, you know, this is when I was a teenager. I liked metal music and I liked things that were fast and aggressive. I didn't really care about, you know, these hokey. Yeah. I didn't even know what to call it. You know, as I kind of progressed, in my musical taste, not that I don't like metal now, but as I kind of became more open to listening to other things, I kind of stumbled upon it as I, you know, opened the door to more folk and rock stuff of, you know, an earlier era. But, my now wife, we were going back to visit her hometown, this small town in Southern Ontario called Ingersoll. And Garth Hudson, the organist, keyboardist, multi-instrumentalist from the band, was playing the folk festival there called the Canterbury Folk Festival.
Oh, wow.
And also around that time, I was in film school and we were watching, we were in American documentary class and we watched The Last Waltz. And, you know, that really got my head spinning a little bit as well. So these kind of things coincided, as well as a local a community theater play about Richard Manuel from the band happening. And kind of all these things led me to really diving in. I'm an obsessive type. Like once I like something or I'm interested in something, I'll go really deep into researching it and learning it. And then, you know, all those kind of things led me to the band exactly where I needed to be at that time. The music just hit me in a way that it hadn't before. And from that moment, I, you know, really became an obsessive, reading everything that you could find, watching everything that you can find. And with the band, as we know, some of the materials aren't necessarily the most accessible, and they're kind of a mysterious type of group, or that's the mystique that they definitely put on during their earlier years. So definitely some of their peers, like the Beatles or the Stones, who I'd kind of come to first, were a little bit more accessible at the beginning. But it started with that kind of hatred of The Wait, but coming to love the group as a whole a couple years later.
That's awesome. I really despise Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen, and that song in particular has prevented me from ever going deeper. And so when we tackled his Born to Run album, I was like, this is amazing. How did I let that be a barrier all these years? So I find myself wondering, you've talked a little bit about this community of people who love the band opening up. My hunch, I guess, in hearing just how detailed your journey is, that it's been more than just, you know, reading the few books that are out there about this group. It sounds like there's been people who've been telling their stories and helping you along this journey as well. Where do you get your research from as you have been moving through this?
I definitely found it challenging at the beginning, because before the podcast, I'm a filmmaker, producer. That's what I do for a living. And one of my final thesis projects very early on in my career is I was going to try to tackle a documentary on one of the band's vocalists and pianists, Richard Manuel. And it was deeply challenging, not only from a research perspective and getting footage and rights and things of that nature, but also getting individuals to speak. A lot obviously had been deceased, because this is, you know, a band that the living members are in their, you know, higher in their 70s, 80s. So a lot of people have deceased. They're rock stars. They live hard lives. And I say, so did their peers. So it was very challenging. And that documentary really never got finished for a myriad of reasons. And that frustrated me, because I like to finish projects, and I was really passionate about the band. So a couple of years later, when I started the podcast, I found it easier in a lot of ways. There's a number of great written materials out there, especially like Barney Hoskins or Grail Marcus, who are noted historians and writers, music critics, and they've written quite a bit. There's a lot of stuff that's auxiliary from like Dylan books, because of the band's connection with Dylan in such an intertwined way that you can get some info there. There's a great website built by this amazing gentleman back in the 90s, very early internet forums. And he built a website that collected band fans together, and they started sharing posters, bootlegs, photos. That still exists, called The Band, HIOF. You can Google that and you can find it. And, there's a lot of the primary sources in the books and in the articles. I use that website also as a reference point. I conduct a lot of my own research questions, whether it's from occasion, talking to Robbie about certain things to clarify things, or talking to certain engineers or people who are around, or talking to Garth Hudson to clarify some things. So there's a lot of unique and interesting challenges. Also, because the band being so intertwined with a lot of musical acts throughout the 60s and 70s, one of the most important things to do was not just have that narrow focus of looking just for information about the band, quote unquote, but I want to find out more about what they did with Eric Clapton. Well, we had to start going down the Eric Clapton hole and find out, you know, what he was doing during that time. You can start to find those pieces and linking things back together, or Van Morrison, or you name it, anybody in the 60s and 70s, there was some connection in some way. And then you can start kind of picking up the pieces that way. So it's a research challenge, but it's definitely fun. And there's kind of sources everywhere. And with the internet, every day there's something new. There was just new bootlegs released in the last month. So it's like you're always getting a new surprise every day when you wake up.
Wow.
How receptive have the guys in the band and very close to the band been to talk to you or to do with you? Like, you know, you're talking to Garth and you're talking to Robbie. I mean, that... I'm trying to make my eyes not fall on my head, you know, and when I listen to some of the stuff on the podcast, but were they, you know, were they, I mean, you mentioned it, they are a lot older now. They're not in the limelight anymore. I mean, Garth probably never, ever wanted to be, but, Have they been receptive, you know, to just to have an email or a call, or how, what's your experience with them?
Certainly. At the very beginning of the podcast, Sebastian, one of Robbie's children, who is very active in the like legacy and the band in terms of like their social media presence and all of that kind of stuff, was very receptive and helpful at pushing out the show. Robbie is supported in a couple different ways. Garth, I talked to before the show. Garth isn't, he's always been this interesting character. He's an eccentric type of guy, a brilliant guy. A lot of people have tried to interview him and have failed. He's challenging because he's not really one to sit and have an interview like we're having right now, or a chat where we're kind of just throwing questions and answers back. Like, you'll give him a question and he'll just go on, but not in a bad way, in an amazing way. And you just let him go because it's like everything, you're like, whoa, okay. And then you try to bring him back and then it doesn't work, but it doesn't matter. So that's, you know, when you're talking to Garth, that's great. When you try to interview him, that's not so great if you have like some goal in mind. I did put out an interview. I really had to, you know, be pretty focused on getting what I wanted there. But Garth has been great. And there's a lot of other auxiliary characters. There's John Simon, who is fundamental in this music, very underrated, almost like another member of the band, kind of like the George Martin to the Beatles, produced the Brown album. He's still around and accessible. Elliot Landy, who took a lot of the famous photographs. So a lot of these people around and are very eager to talk. You know, it is a community though, so you have to gain trust. You have to be careful. Yeah. You never look to exploit or sensationalize, especially because of some of the darker things that happened in the band's history. So it's like, you've got to be careful. You got to be respectful. And you know, that's not only for me, but also the community as a whole, practicing that respect, because these people are willing to talk and engage if you give them that kind of, you know, space to.
It strikes me as I listen to your episodes, just how much time you've poured into the details. Two of your recent episodes are the first two parts of a, we're still not sure how many part episode on The Last Waltz. And, you know, I think your first episode ends and you still haven't gotten to the first band coming on stage, right? And I think like, wow, there's so much there. It strikes me that like you're also pouring yourself into the structure of each podcast episode. It's not like Mike and I just sitting down and rambling together. You've really thought through what you want to say in each one, the interviews being slightly different than that. But I guess I find myself wondering, do you want to put these words on paper down the road and do what some folks have done, turn an audio content into a final published work of some kind?
No, that's a great question. I'd say most of the work goes into the writing portion of the show. The recording of it is, you know, usually takes a few hours at max, and then the edit. So it's kind of like at the beginning and the end, it takes so much time. And definitely some thought goes into the structure, but I will say, generally speaking, I have a plan, but once I get into what I'm in, it often changes. It's definitely malleable. The Last Waltz, there's always something to grapple. Earlier on in the show's definitely grown, and it hasn't been this polished product from the beginning, even with my production background and things. Like, this is a hobby, so it takes different priorities at different times, but early on it was definitely supposed to be lighter and more entertainment. And then I was like, you know, I'm finding all these great pieces of information that I don't think a lot of people know, and I think they would really enjoy. So I try to keep on one-upping myself, and that makes it interesting for me. You know, it just makes it kind of fun to go back. So I could do a Last Waltz episode and it would be, you know, 40 minutes long, but I want to dive into every piece. I also want to really deconstruct certain narratives. The band is, and it's not just a band, I guess you could say it about a lot of artists actually, but there's lots of narratives, good and bad, that surround the band, and people just take them at face value. Why would they not? You know, it's easy. It's like, you know, this is the course of events. This happened, and this happened. Or this is how we remember this. Like we take a look at Woodstock and it was all, you know, sunflowers and rainbows and all that, but it was actually a mess. But right, you know, right, how that prevailing narrative is, and the yeah, band's the same way. Like there's stuff underneath the surface. So the Last Waltz in particular, I think there's some interesting things that people don't really think about, especially with the, like the defining document of the band. Like everybody thinks of the Last Waltz. So it's going to be like four parts now, but yeah, there's lots of writing. I've thought about condensing it and putting it into a book of some sort. There is some ideas being thrown out there right now about doing and using kind of some of the success of the podcast as a platform to launch a book of essays, a collection of essays that isn't a new idea. Other people have done it for other artists. A great one came out about Dylan not that long ago, in exploring new ideas in relation to the band in essay form and get a bunch of great writers together and doing that. So that's something that we're definitely thinking about. But there's always new ways you can explore the band, whether it's on film, if it's in podcast form, if it's in written form, taking the show on the road. That's something we've explored as well. So there's definitely a lot of cool ideas. But there's tons of writing. My patrons, they get the transcripts. Oh, cool. I will say, the transcripts are fairly close to the final product, but I do change just because in the edit, sometimes you're like, yeah, that I don't need that line, or that's slightly awkward, or sometimes I'll mash two lines together. I'm not perfect in that regard. And even the final product, sometimes I go back and I listen, I'm like, why did I do that? You know? So, yeah.
That's awesome.
I would change gears a little bit here. We only release the audio. We don't release any video. We have some video right now, and I noticed right away your hat. You have a hat on that says Levon Helm Studios in Woodstock. And I have a couple questions about that. Number one, during his later career, Levon Helm did his Midnight Rambling sessions at his barn, and the song that's on your podcast that one of your friends wrote talks about that and in Levon's barn. We're a little younger, so I assume you didn't get a chance to go down. But have you, I assume you visited though, since you have the hat, anything about those pieces?
No. Yeah. Yeah. I'm wearing my, Levon Helm Studio hat. I've got a Levon 80th and 80th birthday celebration t-shirt on.
Awesome.
I've got a lot of band merch.
cool.
You know, yes, unfortunately, I'm 26, so I could have definitely listened to the band and listened to Levon when he was alive, but I didn't. So that was, you know, regrettable for myself. I've been to Woodstock. I've been to all of the great locations and like all the history that surrounds it. I've been to all those places and things of that nature. That's great.
That's cool.
You can buy a lot of the merch online. I'd love to support the Levon Helm Studios and the Midnight Rambles. It still continues. They bring in great musical artists and guests. It's a very cool experience. And the Levon Helm Studio definitely deserves all the support, especially if you know the history of it and the barn burning down so many times and all the different bankruptcies and things like that. So it's definitely something that's any way I can help. But yeah, no, Woodstock's a magical place, similar to Disney or, you know, setting foot in the sands of Waikiki Beach in Hawaii. It's like you go to Woodstock and there's something in the air, you know, the history that's made in that area, the amount of really talented individuals that walk those same streets. Some of the people walking those streets still look like they're from that era as well. It's a very cool place. I'd recommend it. Beautiful area in the Catskill Mountains.
Awesome. Ben, maybe we'll have to go down and do something down there together.
Yeah. No, that'd be cool. We're
going to turn 40 next year, so maybe we need to like plan a road trip of things like that. We could do like Cooperstown in New York as well, and hit up some other. I'm sure there's good breweries and other interests of ours around the area too.
Big time.
It would be great, Tyrell, to have you back another time and maybe do a full something. As much as I'd love to do a full thing right now, I guess the intention is just to do a bit of an intro to this previous review. A question about the Brown album, is there a moment it's, I don't want to say, do you have a favorite song? Because I don't think that's fair. but is there a moment or something about the Brown album that, that jumps out to you when you think about it or when you listen to it?
Yeah, I think, you know, the Brown album is a pretty perfect album, if you ask me. I am a little bit biased, but, you know, I do enjoy, thoroughly enjoy other bands and other artists, and there are other perfect albums that I enjoy a lot too. Abbey Road being one of them, or like Beggar's Banquet by the Stones. But across the Great Divide that opens the album, I think is a beautiful, wonderful song. And later on, I think the second side that doesn't get as much love, because the first side, you know, it has some legendary moments. It's got Rag Mama Ray. It's got The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down. It's got Up on Cripple Creek. The second side features a song that I think is incredibly underrated, and that is Jawbone.
Oh, so good.
Yeah.
Time Signature. The Time Signature.
written by Robbie and Richard. You know, Richard loved, as Levon said, to, you know, really kind of throw people for a loop with the Time Signature piece. And we get like 3-4 different Time Signatures in there. The vocals really strong. The lyric is super fun. I think it kind of displays the band's full talent pool and the range that everybody had. But, you know, it's really, it's an era defining album. It's an album that the big artists of the day all really took notice of, along with music from Big Pink. And it changed the trajectory of a lot of artists. Eric Clapton, the Rolling Stones, the Beatles. It's all noted in writing how this album affected them. And that's special because these were trendsetters and are people that you think of as the, you know, defining artists of their era. But the band is kind of at the crux, and, you know, the reason why a lot of that happened, along with Bob Dylan, they're the musician's band. You know, every musician talk to knows the band. They listen to the band. They respect them. And that, I think that is the most important thing. Even more than commercial sale or cultural relevance, being respected by your fellow musicians and influencing them enough to change sound and go back to basics and kind of leave the 60s psychedelia behind, which is great. But, you know, like all things, good things must end.
Yeah.
And really go back to basics and really kind of, you know, change careers. The Stones went into their peak album period during that back to basics time. While the Beatles kind of ended, their last few albums are incredibly strong and leading into their solo career, especially George. Eric Clapton deciding to leap Cream and kind of really focus on a couple of different projects. You know, these are just some of the examples that are, you know, out there. So
yeah,
I think the Brown album is a defining album of that era. It really caps it off in a beautiful way. And that, I think the music is timeless. You can go back and listen to it today, and it's got that timeless quality to it.
We are fortunate to be able to tackle this album and music from Big Pink. We could talk about the weird phenomenon of this 2020 list dropping music from Big Pink from previously being ahead of the Brown album to now being way past it, down at number 100. But I'm curious, and this is said as somewhat of a still learning fan of the band, but what is your guess as to why they were never quite able to capture Fire in a Bottle in the same way that they did with these first two masterpieces?
Is it
just that the personalities never quite clicked again? Was there too much fame from this album that meant that they were a little too soft to really ever recapture that again? Or do you have a theory?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things that you can take a look at. First of all, the rapid succession of their first three albums that a lot of people think are, you know, the big three albums, music from Big Pink, the self-titled and Stage Fright, happened in 3 years. Okay. It's similar. Yeah. People don't think about it like the Beatles only really putting out, you know, being a band longer, but like putting out albums in like an 8-year period, basically. Like, that's insane.
Yep.
A lot of these artists were doing that. And nowadays you get an album every like 3-4 years from some of these artists. Right. So I think there was a lot of creativity tapped. I think there was a skyrocketing of fame. Like, you know, while they don't have the commercial success of the Beatles or the Stones, they were selling at Wembley and they were huge for a pretty short period of time in that kind of rapid succession. I think does a lot. There was pretty bad alcoholism and drug use by the entirety of the band. And when you mix those things together, it doesn't work after a while. I think that also these guys were in a group for nearly a decade before they recorded their first album. So, you know, you get tired of each other after a little bit. Yeah. You start having separate lives. You're not teenagers anymore. You know, you have your own families. You have your own personal problems that you're dealing with. I also think power dynamics shifted in the band early on. It was definitely Levon's group. It quickly shifted to Robbie's group in terms of a leadership component. And while productive at first, I don't think that productivity really was inspired under Robbie much further. And I think Richard Manuel was the secret sauce. He was the important component really to make it go on. If you look at the first album, Music from Big Pink, the songwriting credits are very even across the board. Robbie 4, Richard 4, Rick Danko 1, Bob Dylan 2. Brown album, still Richard in there, but a little bit more Robbie. By the third album, less Richard, less everybody else. And Robbie's a great songwriter, but like, I don't think he had enough in it to sustain it. You know, that's not to say that they didn't do good things. It just became a little bit more inconsistent. Northern Light, Southern Cross, Team, their comeback album is a remarkable album. I really employ people to go out and listen to it. When the band got back together in the 80s and made albums in the 90s, Jericho from 93 is an exceptional album. Definitely go listen to it. I think, though, you kind of fall under the pressure of your own perfection. You know, if people are telling you that music from Big Pink and the Brown album are these defining albums, like I was just saying, and literally other artists are changing the course of their life, I think that mentally screws you up a little bit, even if you don't want to admit it. Like, how you're like, oh, God, I got to make a perfect album again. You know? You can see it in everything. It's like, how do you deal with pressure? If you're watching sports, if you're watching the basketball game, if you're Michael Jordan, you're going to the finals every year. I got to keep on topping that. I got to keep on getting to that level again. It's really hard to sustain and not everybody can do it. So I think that's, you know, a couple of the things without going, you know, on this huge tangent, but I think it was a mixture of fame, personality, who is really taking charge, you know, inner band dynamics. It's really hard when you have a group of guys together trying to do something. It's all of those things.
I've got this piece in my head that I've never really been able to articulate terribly well, but I always find it odd that we hold up this primarily Canadian group as creating an iconic Americana album. I always find that really weird. And I don't know that we need to talk through that here on the podcast recording, but I find it really fascinating. And maybe it is just this one good old boy bringing it all up with him from the deep south.
I can give you an answer that I'll try to be very concise about it, because it's a question that a lot of people have tried to tackle. A lot of people have given some good answers. It is a question that, you know, how are, you know, four Canadians, one American able to create the defining genre of Americana music? I think it does have to do with Levon Helm's deep southern heritage. That is an important, crucial thing. While his name might be not listed next to the songwriting credits because of technicalities, Levon Helm was definitely an influence on a lot of the writing. Like, you don't have The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down without Levon Helm. You don't have Rag Mama Rag. You don't have Strawberry Wine. You don't have Up on Cripple Creek. You don't have those things. It's very simple. You just don't have them. I think the band spent an exceptionally long amount of time in the South touring with Ronnie Hawkins, similar to, you know, the Beatles going over to Germany and just pounding the rock for 10,000 hours. The band did that in the States. They saw a lot of the working class, impoverished people. And I think it's that outsider perspective. And you guys, you know, can probably see this too. When you're in everything, when you're in your own stuff, it's really hard to see it from another perspective. But when you take a step back, you can start to see things.
Yeah.
So you have four Canadians coming to America. They're going to see things in a little bit of a different light than your everyday American will.
Yeah.
And I think that commentary helped, you know, that fresh perspective got American critics and American fans really thinking about a lot of things in a different way. So if you look at things and defining things about a culture or about a thing, you'll often see a lot of times the person that is most able to put it into words or have an opinion about it a lot of times is an outsider. Mm-hmm. So I think some of those things led to them kind of stumbling into this.
That's a good answer. I mean, I guess we get that a little bit with Neil Young too, right? And he sings quite frequently about the South and needing to clean up their act. And you need almost an outsider perspective to sort of get that perspective sometimes.
Exactly. Exactly.
This has been absolutely delightful. As you said, I could ask 1,000 more questions, but I'm not going to now. We'll have to arrange something else. But, well, of course, we want to thank you, Tyrell, for joining us. Thank you for sharing your thoughts, your inspiration about your project, the band, A History Podcast, your passion for the band, your passion for the Brown Album, of course, that's what we're talking about. And thank you again for just taking a little time out of your day to join us. This has been fantastic.
No, thank you guys for having me on. I can't skip an opportunity to talk about the band, but also you guys are doing a very cool thing. I think it's really interesting. I like the variety of it. Sometimes I wish I had a little bit more variety, the ability to really tap into all these different albums, these, you know, defining historical pieces of artwork. And, you know, thank you for letting me come on and rant and rave a little bit. I sure had a lot of fun. So thanks, guys.
You're welcome.
Well, we only have 440 more to go. So if there's something that catches your eye and you really want to ramble on with two guys with no credentials, we'd love to have you. And if you haven't subscribed already, please go do that. You can find the band of history just about anywhere you get podcasts. Click subscribe. Become a Patreon too. Support this history preserving project here that Tyrell has undertaken. It's really powerful and really incredible.
Appreciate it, guys. Thank you.
Absolutely. So we hope you'll stick around just in a minute for our previous review of the Brown Album. And of course, we hope you'll join us next time when we tackle another album.
Yeah, at number 58, we've got another self-titled album. This is Led Zeppelin's, four or IV or no title at all if you want to be very literal. That iconic album comes in at number 58, so we'll be discussing that next time.
Our previous review of the band's Brown Album coming up right after this.
We hope you enjoyed that classic episode of ours. Tune in next time for the next album on the new 2020 Rolling Stone list.